Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll discuss whether interim housing might be a key solution to the Bay Area's homelessness crisis, which has proven so tough to address. And then we'll speak with Ruth Whitman, author of the recent book Boy Mom, about the challenges facing today's boys. But first, last November's election brought big changes to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. Veteran local politicians like Aaron Peskin and Dean Preston were termed out or lost re-election, and the board gained five new members. We here at State of the Bay thought you might want to hear from our city's newest leaders, so we're inviting each of them on our show for a conversation. And we're kicking off the series tonight with Bilal Mahmoud, the new supervisor for District 5, which includes the Tenderloin, Hayes Valley, Western Addition, Fillmore, Alamo Square, Japantown, NOPA, and Haight-Ashbury. So welcome to State of the Bay, Supervisor Mahmoud.
Thank you, Ethan. I appreciate you having me on the show.
And congratulations on your election. So first, let me start by just asking you to talk a little bit about your background and why you decided to run for the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, so the District 5 specifically represents a deep personal history and story and empathy for me. My family are immigrants. They moved to this country over 40 years ago, and I grew up in the peninsula. And growing up, San Francisco provided that taste of a home away from home. The Tenderloin specifically was a hub for the Pakistani community, for food that we'd visit almost every month. And that's what it always represented. And I think there's a lot of beauty in this district. And unfortunately, over the last several years, there's been a lot of challenges, from homelessness to fentanyl, food insecurity, public safety. And it's not the same Tenderloin that we would visit as a child growing up. And so during the pandemic, I saw a lot of these issues coming to a head and decided to enter into local politics. I had worked in the Obama administration and small business policy. I'd worked in technology and really felt that a lot of the solutions that were missing in San Francisco was a lack of focus on the basics, a lack of focus on the priorities that are needed in this district that were necessary for my family to break into the middle class, and wanted to realign the priorities for San Francisco and District 5 and the Tenderloin and get us back on the basics.
Well, and you referenced some of the challenges in the district. And of course, you defeated Dean Preston, a Democratic socialist who had served on the board since 2019, representing the district you now represent. Do you view your victory as a sign that San Francisco residents are frustrated with progressive politics?
I'd say they're frustrated with lack of progress. I consider myself a progressive, and progressive from my perspective means that you make progress on making sure more people are housed. You make progress on making sure that our streets are safe and clean, and you make progress on the fentanyl crisis, which has been affecting this district at an extraordinary level for several years. And the residents of this district had not seen enough progress on those outcomes of building more housing or addressing our fentanyl crisis, and they wanted change. And so right as we came into office, we got to work. We worked in a collaborative way with our mayor, something that also was missing, I think, for a long time, is people wanted collaboration, a sense of congeniality, and a sense of focusing on the outcomes. So in the first month, we passed an emergency ordinance alongside Mayor Lurie to give the government the powers it needs to shut down the open-air drug market. And then tomorrow, we'll be introducing legislation that prioritizes new approaches to shutting down the open-air drug market to leverage those tools that the mayor now has.
And so I'm curious then, what would you describe as your maybe sort of top three agenda items that you want to accomplish as a supervisor? I mean, you've referenced public safety, fentanyl, homelessness. Do you have a list? Do you have a top priority?
Sure, yeah.
You're trying to enact?
Yeah, in no order of priority, but the three main goals that we are focused on are the fentanyl crisis as it affects the city. Second is housing, and third is broadly good governance. On the fentanyl crisis, like we alluded to, we've had the largest amount of overdoses in the city in this district, and it's been growing year over year, and we need new approaches. So tomorrow I'll be introducing legislation that advocates for a drug market intervention strategy, which is an evidence-based approach that has successfully shut down down open air drug markets across the country, and it focuses on collaboration between city departments, deterrence and prevention, workforce development, shutting down the open air drug market by getting all the different departments to work together, SFPD, public health, but also focusing on prevention, like workforce development for people coming out of prison or first-time offenders to make sure they don't go back into the trade. On housing, we're the slowest city to build in the entire state of California, and we are not meeting our housing element goals. We have to build nearly 80,000 units over the next several years, and we are nowhere close to being at pace for that. And what we're going to be focusing on this year is permitting reform. Where if you look at the entire Bay Area, despite the same interest rates, the same labor conditions, we're still the slowest. And so we are working in collaboration with the mayor, who just announced the Permit SF initiative, to focus on how do we smash the bureaucracy with a chisel, and going line by line and finding those codes that are blocking the ability to build housing and reforming them. And then that leads into good governance. I think there's so many things within City Hall that a lot of residents have been frustrated with, which is, why do we have a $1 billion budget but no outcomes on homelessness? Why are certain things still done on paper when we're in the 21st century? And so we want to go through some of those components and find how do we make government work better for the people, and reduce some of the red tape and bureaucracy on many other issues beyond just fentanyl crisis and public safety.
Well, we're speaking with new San Francisco Supervisor Bilal Mahmood, representing District 5, which includes the Tenderloin, Hayes Valley, Western Addition, Fillmore, Alamo Square, Japantown, NOPA, and Haight-Ashbury. You're listening to State of the Bay on KALW San Francisco Public Radio. I'm Ethan Elkind. And speaking of your district, Supervisor Mahmood, we did get an email in from Lisa, who's been a resident of your district for 40 years, about a proposed action by the mayor. She wrote to us that tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors hearing, the supervisors will vote on Mayor Lurie's attempt to remove Vice Chair of the Police Commission, Max Carter Oberstone. In November's election, voters strongly supported robust oversight of city departments and rejected handing more power to the mayor. Lisa writes that Commissioner Oberstone is a champion of civil rights, justice, and transparency and should be left to finish his term. So, Supervisor Mahmood, where do you stand on this removal proposal?
Yeah, I'm talking to all sides. I'm talking to Max. I'm talking to the mayor's office, and we'll make a determination tomorrow about after we balance both perspectives. And I think we appreciate some of Max's, what I've gathered, his role on police accountability, but we want to hear the mayor's office out as well and see what is their respective vision for what we feel the police commission's role is in society and in City Hall. And so we'll make a decision tomorrow at the board.
And your district was also in the news in January when the Fillmore Safeway store closed its doors. That was a big blow. And Lisa, longtime resident of your district, also sent us a question about that, asking what your plans are for the district's elderly and low-income residents now that the Fillmore Safeway is closed. She writes that it's basically a food desert and so wants to know, what is the plan now? What are the next steps?
Yeah, I mean, this is an urgent crisis in our district is food insecurity. And with the Safeway closing, there's over 34,000 residents, many seniors, communities of color, residents who are affected. Once we came into office, we held a hearing. It was the first hearing that was actually held on this issue, despite the announcement of the Safeway's closure happening over a year ago. And we gathered the city departments to learn what is their plans and what are they doing going forward. And we pulled those services together. And so our focus has been on developing short, medium, long-term solutions since that hearing that we gathered. The first is working with city departments to ensure that they are providing the transit resources as well as food access resources, and then connecting the communities with those immediate resources that are available, like Booker T. Washington and MTA transit resources as well. Anyone can go to our website at the Board of Supervisors under Supervisor Mahmood on District 5 resources, and we've gathered all the different resources people can get in the short term. And importantly, since the hearing, my office began dialogue with Safeway, and which has been productive. And we've made it clear that our priority is getting a grocery store into the parcel as fast as possible to create positive outcomes for our neighbors in the Fillmore, Western Addition, and Japantown. So we're focusing on short-term solutions, medium and long-term. And again, focusing back on permitting, cleaning up the legislation and the bureaucratic codes that are inhibiting the ability to get in a new grocery store. And the hearing, we found that if we wanted to get a new grocery store in today, it would take 8 months of different permitting rules that we need to clean up. So we're focusing on making sure the government's making it easier to get a replacement grocery store while we negotiate with the respective parties as well.
And we're just about out of time. I did want to ask you about Muni as well. Muni, of course, is facing a big transit financial cliff. What are your thoughts about what can be done to try to balance any service cuts that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we've been advocating to Muni to ensure that there are no service cuts and there's continued service reliability for the communities across this district. Our office is meeting weekly with MTA to communicate that, and we're finding different collaborative solutions. They've proposed solutions like leveraging funds from the general fund or increasing the parking meter fees from like 6 o'clock on weekdays all the way to 10 o'clock, which is what most major cities do. And so there's a couple of different creative proposals that we're working with MTA on to ensure that we don't have any cuts to Muni, and we'll be advocating for those clearly. But we have been very consistent and confident that we are advocating that there should be no service cuts for Muni.
All right. Well, last question, not a gotcha, but we'd love to just know your favorite local restaurant and favorite place to go in the city.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go with Shalimar on Jones Street in the Tenderloin. It's the restaurant I grew up going to when I would visit San Francisco in the TL. It's been there for almost 30 years. I've been going there since I was the age of 8, and they still have the same menu at the exact same price as 30 years ago. So it's kind of like the Costco of Pakistani food. So I would recommend it for anyone who visits San Francisco.
Great. Well, always love those restaurants that have that kind of connection to your past and history and childhood. So wonderful to get that recommendation and to hear from you and your priorities. Thank you so much, Supervisor Bilal Mahmood, new supervisor for District 5, for joining us on State of the Bay, and good luck with the rest of your term.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll delve into the Bay Area's homelessness crisis and talk about solutions. That's after the break.
Hi, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch, and I'm the host of KALW's new segment, Natural State. It features soundscapes from ecosystems all over California. It's a chance to slow down and listen up. Tune in every Wednesday at 7:15 a.m. and 3:45 p.m. Natural State. Only here on KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
This week on the Arts, a farewell of sorts. I'm David LaTulipe, and this week's show will be my last as host, passing the torch to Janae Darden, who joins me this week, along with KALW's Executive Director James Cass and other guests, for a discussion on the future of the arts in the Bay Area. Your calls are welcome as well. In tribute or criticism, that's Wednesday afternoon at 4 on the Arts. Join us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. California's struggles with homelessness are well documented. Setting aside the harsh national media narrative about California and cities like San Francisco, it's certainly evident from recent data, which shows that approximately half of the nation's unsheltered population and nearly one-third of those who are homeless reside in our state here in California. Even in the Bay Area, known for its progressive values, the visibility of unhoused individuals in neighborhoods, near businesses, and in public spaces has sparked a backlash. Homelessness has become a defining issue in recent local elections across nearly every city in the region. And here to discuss why this crisis has been so difficult to solve and examine some of the new approaches our local cities are taking to address it, I'm pleased to be joined by two guests. First, I want to welcome Elizabeth Funk, founder and CEO of Dignity Moves, a nonprofit organization dedicated to finding scalable solutions to unsheltered homelessness. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And we're also happy to have Matt Mahan, the mayor of San Jose, who has made homelessness a top priority in his administration. Welcome, Mayor Mahan.
Well, thanks for having me.
And before we begin, we also want to hear you, our listener, your thoughts on the homelessness crisis. Have you lost faith that our cities can find a solution, or have you seen progress in your area? And if you or someone you know has experienced homelessness, we'd love to hear your story. You can send us your thoughts and questions via email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can also find us on social media or call us. We are at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, I want to begin questions here by just starting with a troubling statistic. California is home to about half of the nation's unsheltered population. That's over 123,000 people at the last count. And that's not the total number of homeless individuals, but specifically those living without any form of shelter. Elizabeth, let me start with you. Why is unsheltered homelessness a bigger issue in California than in the rest of the country?
Well, I think largely it's due to our housing costs and the building costs and the permitting and the entitlements and the scarcity of land over time has driven up the cost of permanent housing to a point where it's just not feasible to build permanent housing for everyone who's experiencing homelessness. So there end up being longer and longer waiting lists. Sometimes a decade someone will wait for that permanent housing. And the only place they can really be is on the streets, because California has underinvested in shelter and interim solutions.
And Elizabeth, for years, California has prioritized building permanent supportive housing as the primary solution to homelessness. But when you founded Dignity Moves, you chose to focus on interim housing instead. And we can dive into what that looks like in a moment. But first, can you just talk about what challenges you've seen with the permanent supportive housing model?
Well, sure. The biggest problem is cost and time. So across California, it's costing us an average of $800,000 per unit to build permanent supportive housing and over $1 million in our bigger cities. So the reality is that's not going to scale. For every one person who is exiting the system into that permanent supportive housing, three are falling into homelessness. So we have to have other alternatives. And yet we've chosen to underinvest in shelter and temporary solutions because technically those don't end homelessness. If someone comes from the street into a temporary place, they're still classified as homeless. They're just a sheltered homeless. And so cities, ironically, have a perverse incentive to get one person into a $1 million apartment, then 30 into something that's less expensive and temporary because of metrics.
And Mayor Mahan, when you took office in 2023, what was San Jose's primary strategy for addressing homelessness at the time? And what, in your view, were its shortcomings?
Well, Elizabeth and I have a lot of areas of agreement here. And when I ran for mayor the first time, about 3 years ago, I pointed out the exact dynamic that Elizabeth is describing, where the entire focus and literally 90% of the dollars and the focus of those of us in government was placed on building the ideal solution. And we all agree it's the ideal solution. If you can create a permanent, long-term, affordable place for someone to live, you are most likely to reduce the likelihood that they will ever fall into homelessness again. But effectively, we were helping the lucky few while condemning thousands of other less fortunate homeless individuals to be condemned to chronic homelessness, to life on the streets. And I made the argument that we really need to shift to a continuum of solutions and rebalance our investments and build more interim housing, convert more motels, create basic shelter, and put more of the emphasis on stabilizing people and getting them connected to services faster. And that's what we've been doing in San Jose. We've made a pretty significant pivot over the last 2 years. And so far, it's actually demonstrating results in the performance data that we collect.
Well, you mentioned interim housing. I referenced it a second ago. And I think let's delve into this. And Elizabeth, I know that your organization also advocates for a shift toward interim housing solutions. Can you first just describe what interim housing is, how it differs from traditional shelters?
Sure. Well, interim housing is intended to be a place where people can stay for a short period of time, like Mayor Mahan referenced, to get stabilized and figure out what their next step is. And in California, we've declared a crisis, a shelter crisis. And cities that are treating this like a crisis can invoke the Shelter Crisis Act and waive all sorts of ordinances and bureaucracy and red tape so that they can build housing that is temporary, but therefore really fast. Because the fast is the important thing. When people first become homeless, the vast majority do not yet have the debilitating mental and behavioral health that we see on the people in the streets. That sets in once they're on the streets. And yet when we have too few places for people to go, then the people who are most vulnerable and the next one in line that's been waiting the longest gets that housing, which means tragically, the people who are newly homeless have to wait until they've lost their mind, literally, before they can get into housing. And so what we think is that if we can do really inexpensive, albeit not forever, think of it as a Dixie cup instead of your fine china, but it works. It's a cup and people can get in and we can do it at scale, then that makes a lot more sense and fewer people are going to require the supportive housing that is so expensive.
A Dixie cup is definitely better than no cup at all. And Elizabeth, what kind of supportive services then are offered to residents in interim housing locations?
Well, see, that's the most important thing. And I should specify and clarify that we call this interim housing because by definition, everyone has their own room with a door that locks. The concept of shelter of the past, big warehouses with bunk beds, people don't want to go. And because they don't want to go, governments don't build them. So we don't have enough anyway. So what we do is do little tiny cabins where everybody has, I think of them as tiny homes, has their own space with a door that locks. And the magical thing is people don't turn it down. We have this stereotype that people prefer cement pillows. They don't. They prefer it to a bunk bed. And so the attraction is to have your own private space. But the real benefit is that then they're in a mindset where the supportive services have a really good chance of working. When they calm and feel safe, that's when we can wrap them with supportive services, case managers and behavioral and mental health care, and help them get their documents ready, their driver's license renewed, all the things that can tee them up so that they can have a successful exit and get to stability.
We're talking about how to solve the homelessness problem in California, the homelessness crisis. We're speaking to Elizabeth Funk, founder and CEO of Dignity Moves, a nonprofit organization dedicated to finding scalable solutions to unsheltered homelessness, and San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, who has made homelessness a top priority in his administration. And Mayor Mahan, you've talked about how you have been prioritizing interim shelters over permanent affordable housing. What, in your view, makes this approach more viable? And can you talk about what's been happening so far under your mayoral administration in terms of advancing interim shelters?
Sure, and I wanna be clear, we are doing both. We are still continuing to build permanent affordable housing in San Jose, and we agree that it's a great solution for those who have access to it. The advantage of interim solutions is what Elizabeth was describing. It's really speed and scalability. We can build them much faster. We can do it more cost effectively, which means we can get more people off of our streets and connected to supportive services faster. For some people, that's sufficient. They don't even have to wait for that permanent apartment. If they have access to job training, drug treatment, support for reconnecting with family, they may find their own path to something more permanent. So getting people stabilized quickly and being able to do that at a scale that meets the magnitude of this crisis is critically important. We have built, since the start of the pandemic, we have now opened about 700 units of modular construction. They all look a little different, but they're essentially the individual rooms, the cabins that Elizabeth is describing. And we've worked with different developers. Some have in-suite private bathrooms, some don't. There are different formulations, but that's essentially what they are. We've also opened a few hundred motel rooms where we have purchased underperforming, dilapidated motels using Project Home Key dollars, fixed them up and reopened them as interim or transitional housing. We've done safe parking sites and are now opening our first safe sleeping site. So we're really creating a full continuum. We want to ensure everybody on our streets has a safe and managed place where they can be with access to security, case management, sanitation, three meals a day, and just some dignity and stability.
And Mayor Mahan, I know you've also outlined a preliminary plan, at least at a recent city council meeting, to get the city to what's called functional zero unsheltered homelessness. Can you explain what that term means, functional zero, and why you set that goal?
Sure. The idea behind achieving functional zero is having a sufficiently built out shelter, interim housing, and permanent housing system, that continuum I was describing, building it out enough such that people are exiting homelessness at a faster rate as others are falling into homelessness, so that no one is condemned to live on the streets and become chronically homeless and face all of the other challenges that Elizabeth was referencing around declining behavioral health, higher likelihood of substance abuse, et cetera. So what we've done is modeled out, I sort of asked our staff the hypothetical question, if we were much more pragmatic and willing to pivot to a broader spectrum of solutions, building out more of these interim solutions to build up our system capacity, how quickly and how cost effectively, what would be the price tag to get to that functional zero number? And part of what motivated me to ask that question was, when we only looked at one solution, which happened to be the slowest and most expensive solution, the price tag was about $5 billion and the timeline was very uncertain. It appeared to be well over a decade, maybe a couple of decades if we were lucky, if we could get the $5+ billion. What we found through our modeling is for about $250 million, so about 5% of that cost, if we embrace these more scalable solutions, we could offer a dignified bed and a connection to supportive services to everyone on our streets and achieve that functional zero benchmark with just a fraction of the dollars. And therefore, because they're faster to deploy, a fraction of the time as well. And so we really believe that we're onto something here. We still have a long way to go. We don't have $250 million just sitting in our general fund. We're going to need partnership from the county and the state and philanthropic and corporate partners. But that's an achievable number. That's on an order of magnitude that is realistic for public agencies, especially when partnered with philanthropic and private sector partners to actually achieve.
And you're listening to State of the Bay on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're talking about homelessness and how to solve it in the Bay Area, in California. We're joined by Elizabeth Funk, founder and CEO of Dignity Moves, a nonprofit organization dedicated to finding scalable solutions to unsheltered homelessness, and San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, who has made homelessness a top priority. And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. If you have experienced homelessness and have a story to tell, if you are close to someone who has and has, and you have some thoughts about solutions or ideas about what cities like San Jose, other cities in the Bay Area can do, please do send us your thoughts, questions via email at stateofthebay@kalw.org, via social media, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We have an email comment in from Rick in Citrus Heights, who writes, just like with the rest of the state of California, contrary to popular belief, if people were smart, they would know that we simply just cannot build our way out of this homelessness and housing crisis. Elizabeth, what's your response to Rick?
Well, we can build our way out of it, but we need to loosen up our definition of housing. There's no reason that we can't have enough places for everyone who needs a place to sleep that's safe. And it may not be the permanent structures that we, you know, that we've come to be familiar with, but there is no reason that we can't end unsheltered homelessness. I think the biggest thing standing in our way is that people think it's not possible. But when exercises happen like San Jose has done, which is incredible, to actually quantify and say, of course it's solvable. Here's what it would look like. Even if we don't have that money, when you've studied and analyzed and described and named your problem, you're halfway to solving it. And I think believing that this is possible is the most important step.
And Ethan, if I might pick up on that just quickly, part of the reason we're in this crisis, as we started the conversation saying, is our failure to build. I don't know if people understand this, but over the last 20 years, in at least the South Bay, and I think this is largely true across our region, we have seen job creation dramatically outpace housing production. We have created in the San Jose metro area, Silicon Valley, we've created 6 new jobs for every 1 new home we've built. That is an unsustainable ratio. It's not that we aren't building, but it's been very lopsided. We're building commercial, we're not building a lot of residential, and it's that lopsided growth that creates an imbalance of supply and demand and drives prices up faster than incomes. And I apologize for the economics briefing here, but I think it's important to be rooted in the data. That being said, to Rick's point, I fully support And I've been a strong advocate for accountability for things like drug treatment and mental health care. And I do believe that for some people, a first stop may need to be a treatment center. And I think we need to hold our state and our counties accountable for other first stops off of the streets. But ultimately, we do as a city, state, and country have to balance job and population growth with housing production, or we're going to always face this kind of crisis.
Well, I appreciate the question from Rick and both of your responses to this question around the supply issue around housing. And Elizabeth, I wanted to go back to, we were talking with Mayor Mahan about functional zero policy. I know that Dignity Moves has been involved in functional zero implementation in Santa Barbara and also co-sponsoring legislation at the state level. Just briefly, can you just talk about that legislation in particular and anything else you want to add from your experiences, your experience working on functional zero implementation?
Sure. Well, I think the thing that people don't understand is that for cities like San Jose to prioritize interim housing is a real departure from our national policy. HUD, all the way down for a decade, has been saying that squandering resources on anything that isn't a permanent solution is inappropriate. And there's very little funding for interim solutions. So for a city to be bold like this and say, we're going to prioritize unsheltered homelessness anyway, is really astonishing. And I believe that needs to be the conversation at the state level, because as you referenced at the beginning, half of the nation's unsheltered are in California. This part of the problem is uniquely a California problem, and our state legislature needs to speak up and say, while permanent housing is important, in California, we're going to prioritize getting everyone off of the streets and get this crisis, the immediate crisis, behind us so that the pressure comes off the system when we can build permanent housing. So what the legislation in the state is going to do is require cities to at least assess what it would take to get to functional zero so that we at least know that it's possible. And what's really important is smaller and medium-sized cities are going to need to do their part, because when cities like San Jose step up and go for functional zero, it's real easy for the small cities around to just outlaw camping. And guess where people go? They end up in San Jose. And so we need all of the cities to do their part. And that's what this bill would work towards.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that legislation. I want to ask you both about cost. Obviously, this is not free to address this crisis. And Elizabeth, just to start with you on this question about cost, how does interim housing compare with traditional shelters and permanent housing in terms of cost?
I love this question because we just don't see the numbers. But because the cost to build permanent housing is approximately $1 million, let's say 800,000, depending on your place. But once we've built it, we then care for those people for the rest of their lives because they've been so traumatized that they end up in supportive housing. Interim housing costs maybe $50,000, maybe $75,000 per unit if it's not on paved ground. And that product will last for, say, 10 years. But that ratio, first of all, right there, is a big difference. But what people don't see is the cost of leaving people on the streets. That number averages something like $80,000 per person per year that the taxpayer is paying in one form or another, between encampment sweeps and cleaning up needles and police interventions and wildfires. But they're scattered across so many different departments that we don't see it. And then you look at one budget, which is the housing department, and it looks like a big number. You know, Mahan's talking about, you know, $50 million or something. But we're not seeing, we're spending twice that in just cleaning up after the problem.
And Mayor Mahan, can you talk about the sources of fundings that you've tapped into to be able to build the housing that you've been able to build for the homeless?
Sure. Well, first, I'll just say I think Elizabeth's description there is spot on. The impacts are diffuse and sometimes hidden, and they come in the form of cleaning up and doing outreach without having any bed to offer someone. The impacts on other public services that we all rely on, from emergency rooms to police and fire response. So we have tried to look holistically at costs and take a long-term view and recognize, as Elizabeth is outlining, that if we can get somebody indoors, stabilized in a safe environment with security, sanitation, 3 meals a day, and connection to a case manager who can help them access other services like job training and drug treatment, that we're going to save money in the long run. And I firmly believe that. We have relied on funding from a few sources. The state has had some very effective programs, including HAP funding, which cities, large cities, can access, the Project Room Key funds that allow you to convert motel rooms into interim and ultimately permanent affordable housing. We have done a lot at the local level. We've passed a transfer tax called Measure E that is actually just a general fund source for us. So at the city level, we are paying effectively out of our general fund to expand and modernize a shelter system and really think about it as more than shelter, as Elizabeth was describing. Mm-hmm. To the extent possible, we want to build individual rooms with a door that locks and give people that dignity of privacy. And we know that they're more likely to be successful to accept that housing and be successful in it when we build it. But a lot of that is coming right out of our general fund. And to Elizabeth's point, we need a fair share approach that ensures that every city contributes to building out our shelter and interim housing portfolio in the state, and that every county builds the requisite number of treatment options, including inpatient treatment facilities.
Well, we have an email in from Steve from San Francisco who writes, how long can individuals or families stay in interim housing? And if a city's resources are going towards interim housing rather than more affordable permanent housing, then where are they supposed to move when their time in the shelters runs out? And I suppose a related question to this would just be, are we sure that we're not risking having people in interim housing just cycle back into homelessness? Elizabeth, just want to see if you wanted to address those points about the question around the status of people in interim housing and then what we know about whether or not they end up back homeless and into homelessness afterwards.
Well, the absolute goal is to make sure that people get stabilized and that they can stay as long as it takes for them to find the permanent housing that they need. But the duration that they can stay, the problem is the cost of the supportive services. To operate these sites and provide meals and case management, it's expensive. It's half of the cost of leaving people on the streets, which is, as we said, maybe $80,000 a year, but it's $40,000 per year. And that's not sustainable to come out of city and local budgets. One of the reasons that everyone is sort of so focused on getting people into permanent housing, nothing in life is permanent, as we know, especially for this population, but it's funded by Section 8 vouchers. It's funded by the federal government. And without federal support for the operating costs, we can't allow people to stay very long because we can't afford it. So you're right, there needs to be the throughput, and people come into interim housing and stay as long as necessary while they find the permanent housing. But we also need that permanent housing. And kicking someone out because the time has expired is a devastating mistake, because we have invested in an asset of their stabilization. Mm-hmm. That's an expensive asset to get that person back functioning, and we do not want to squander it because the clock ticked.
And Ethan, I'll just say on the city side.
Yes, please, real briefly, because we're just about out of time. Please proceed.
Sure. Just we don't kick people out. We're low barrier. We let people bring their pets, their partners. We work with them to resolve their homelessness. Kicking people out would completely undermine the value of the investments we've made, to Elizabeth's point.
Well, as I say, we're almost out of time. There's a lot more we could discuss, but just thinking about next steps, how listeners could get involved. Elizabeth, just briefly, what would you suggest to listeners? What issues should they be focusing on? How can they help?
Well, this is an all hands on deck problem. It affects us all, and we can all get involved, from volunteering to helping raise the money for a cabin to contribute. We've got kids doing pancake breakfasts every Sunday. There's so many ways to get involved, but I think most importantly is to be supportive of a change in policy and support leaders like Matt Mahan, who gets a lot of arrows at his back for saying we're going to invest in interim solutions. And we need to be cheering for them and need to be in support of getting everyone indoors, off of our streets, and into humane circumstances.
And Mayor Mahan, just in 30 seconds or so, what's your message to people on this issue? What do you want to convey to them about how they can help and what they need to understand about it?
Well, to Elizabeth's point, I think continuing to stay engaged on the issues and advocating to every level of government to do their part. As I mentioned, we need every city to invest in shelter and services. We need counties to support the funding for those services, including drug treatment and job training. and we need a statewide framework that ensures that everyone's doing their fair share. We don't have all that in place yet. We have a patchwork. It's very uneven, and we need residents to advocate to their elected officials at every level of government to make this a priority and embrace practical, scalable, cost-effective solutions. And I hope San Jose can be a model for those solutions.
Well, we certainly hope so, too. So much more we could talk about. I just want to thank you both for joining us. Elizabeth Funk, CEO of Dignity Moves, and San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan. Thank you both so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear my co-host Grace Wan's interview with Ruth Whitman, author of the book Boy Mom. We'll be right back. On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss a new analysis by Last Chance Alliance that shows that oil and gas companies spent a record $38 million in 2024 to fight climate and environmental justice policies in California. We'll also look at how Donald Trump and Elon Musk's efforts to shrink the federal government have left the country's wildland firefighting force unprepared for the rapidly approaching wildfire season. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Ethan Elkind, and you.
And that will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call here on 91.7 FM, and that will take place this evening at 7 o'clock on KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Amid the hashtag MeToo movement, one unexpected group has been struggling, boys and men. In her candid and thought-provoking book, Boy Mom, Berkeley-based author Ruth Whitman explores the challenges of raising three sons as a feminist. Through her insights, she invites readers to explore a deeper understanding of and compassion for the complexities facing boys and men today. We're so pleased to have you here tonight, Ruth. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks so much for having me.
Boy Mom has been described as part memoir of raising your three boys and part deep journalism. When you got started on the book, what was your intent?
I have three boys, and my third one was born in 2017. So it was right as the Me Too movement was exploding online, and the conversation around toxic masculinity was just so fraught. As a feminist raising sons, I felt so many complicated feelings. I almost felt a mix of kind of defensiveness and disgust and exhilaration and this determination to do better, but also this kind of fear. You know, where were we going wrong with raising boys? Was it just inevitable that all men were going to grow up to be terrible, as the news seemed to be reflecting at that time? And so I think I had this very personal motivation for writing the book, which was just as a mom of boys. And also journalistically, I was really interested, you know, what does it mean to be a boy and to raise a boy in this extremely fraught political and cultural moment?
Your research indicates that boys are actually not thriving. Boys and men are falling behind in health outcomes, schooling, income, and other areas. I'm just curious, were you surprised to find that?
I think I was surprised in the sense that as a feminist, I spent so much of my life and career advocating for women and girls and looking at the problems that women and girls face. And I had it in my mind that patriarchy was great for boys and men. They only benefited from it. But the more I looked at the sort of realities of my own sons' lives and also did all this reporting where I talked to boys and young men across America from all kinds of different backgrounds, I realized just how difficult life was for them in many, many ways, and just how much this sort of patriarchal system actually harmed them too, in terms of their ability to form connected relationships, their ability to express and understand their own emotions, in terms of mental health, in terms of school, all these ways that the system really seemed to be not only benefiting them, but also harming them as well.
I want you to go back a little bit to that moment when you first found out, I'm having a third boy. I mean, I had this experience myself. I didn't have any brothers growing up. My second child is a boy. And I remember thinking, how am I going to raise this kid to be thoughtful and kind and sensitive? I didn't want him to be patriarchal. And I'm curious, what went through your mind in those moments of like,
I'm about to raise a son.
And funnily enough, with the first two boys, I didn't think about it that much. It was almost like if you were having daughters, then you had to worry about gender. Mm-hmm. And if you were having boys, then you didn't really have to worry about that stuff. You know, the boys will be okay. But when the third one was born and we were in the middle of this whole conversation about toxic masculinity, and also I started to notice real negativity from other people. I say I was having a third boy and people would look at me like I was saying that our whole family had the stomach flu or something. We were like back along as if it was catching, you know. They were like, oh, you're going to have your hands full. And it was just this idea that having a boy was the bad thing. And I think it tapped into my own anxieties and my own insecurities about feeling like, can I help these boys? I had only one sister growing up. I went to an all-girls school. My closest friends were female. I was like, I don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to be that positive person going, boys are great, you know, everything's great. But at the same time, I was a bit like, ooh, I don't know if I really feel that way.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by your kind of recognition that patriarchy, which is supposed to help men, is actually hurting them more than we realize.
Yeah, I think that was one of the biggest themes that ran through all of my research. We're like, oh, boys, you know, they become men who can be CEOs and they can be scientists and they can have power. We're essentially talking about power. But what we don't realize is just how much this system gets in the way of connection, intimacy, relationship building, all those sort of softer skills. We instinctively socialize girls to have good relationships, to take on caregiving and nurturing, to connect with other people. But the way we socialize boys, we try to toughen them up and we don't really give them good role models for how to be a fully connected, emotional human being. That really harms them. And we see down the line that there is a male loneliness crisis in this country. And in fact, all over the world, men are struggling to form close friendships. They're relying on their wives and their female partners to do that kind of emotional labor. We don't socialize boys to have those skills and develop those skills for themselves.
As you say in your writing, it's like an impossible masculinity that we have asked boys to try to attain.
Yes. And I deliberately didn't use the phrase toxic masculinity because I feel like it's almost impossible for boys from all sides in this moment. On the one hand, they've got all this old problems with masculinity, the kind of man up, be tough, squash your emotions, don't express how you feel, don't be vulnerable. And those pressures have been on men forever, really. But now they have a bunch of new problems where it's like, you're toxic, you're harmful, you're going to be a predator. The best we can do is just kind of reduce the problems that you're going to cause to everyone else. As Richard Reeves, who writes about this a lot, says, you know, we're developing this idea that men don't have any problems. They are the problem. So I think they're just feeling very shut down from all directions.
Recently, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Meta, in a podcast with Joe Rogan, who is the ultimate Mr. Macho Masculine. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is saying, hey, I want my company to have a little bit more masculine energy.
Yeah.
And there is this bro culture, or as my son says, bro culture, that seems to have permeated these kids' lives. And how is that impacting this ability for boys and young men to have authentic experiences?
You know, the Zuckerberg thing, I think every woman who's ever had a job is kind of looking at that thing. And what the problem is that companies don't have enough masculine energy and Silicon Valley doesn't have enough masculine energy. I mean, I think this just seems like a fantasy land to most women in this country. But also probably to most boys. I interviewed many boys across the United States, really different situations, really different backgrounds. And once you can get past the sort of initial layer of kind of bluster and broing, when they talked about the expectations of masculinity, this was a source of stress for them. They really felt that they had to form this aggressive, posturing, manly thing all the time. And they couldn't really be their authentic, vulnerable selves. They couldn't really connect deeply with their male friends in particular. And if there was one thing that these boys across the board told me in these interviews, it was that they felt lonely. And I thought they would tell me, oh, well, you know, that's just the way we like it. You know, boys will be boys. We want to have these kind of bro kind of relationships. But that is not what they told me at all. They felt that these kinds of masculine expectations were really stressful for them.
I mean, one of your chapters is titled, not just lonely boys, but angry lonely boys. because, you know, loneliness leads to a lot of other feelings. And talk to me a little bit about how that loneliness has manifested itself. I mean, you ended up connecting with the incel community through this.
Yeah. So I took the decision to talk to young men who identify as incels, which stands for involuntary celibate. So they're these boys who don't have sex. They don't have sexual partners and they feel rejected and lonely. And they form these communities online, which are often extremely misogynistic and horrible. You go onto these incel forums and you see the worst, like misogynistic, racist, white supremacist, you name it, horrible, horrible content on there. I wanted to talk to these boys because I think they often represent a very extreme but still kind of logical conclusion to a lot of the trends that we see in more mainstream life for boys and young men. There's so much loneliness. There's so much blaming of their problems on women and other groups. There's this just sort of pervasive feeling of disconnection and hopelessness among so many young men. And what was really fascinating in these groups was there was this extremely toxic content, but there was also this real like tenderness and brotherhood. It was as though when they were anonymous on the internet and when they were sort of giving up on the performance of masculinity and just kind of hopeless that they were never going to succeed, that they were never going to attract women, that they were never going to be these kind of alpha males. It's almost like that hopelessness was kind of freeing to them and they were able to express their emotions. So a lot of these young men on these forums were actually acting in really tender and brotherly ways and expressing their emotions in a way that boys and men often can't do in real life, which was in a weird twisted kind of way, quite touching, but also very scary. You know, this idea that, you know, our boys can't find deep connection in real life. So they're looking for it in these really toxic spaces.
You know, we're living in this moment and we've heard the polls tell us, to the extent that polls can tell us, that it really was young men who fueled Donald Trump's return to the presidency. And that this was a group that felt politically left aside. And in a way, these men are saying, this is our moment. We're tired of being the villains. We want to take back our power, which maybe they'd never really lost. I mean, how do you think that factors into the politics that we're seeing today, the research that you did and what you saw in putting your book together?
So I think it's really fascinating. There is this micro generation of boys and young men that were going through puberty around the time that the Me Too movement kicked off and are now of voting age. And they have spent their entire adolescence in the shadow of this conversation around toxic masculinity, where they have heard over and over again this idea that they are harmful, they are predatory, they are the cause of all society's problems, and crucially, that their own problems don't matter. And they're told again and again that they are privileged and powerful and they have all the benefits. And yet in their own lives, they don't recognize it. They don't see themselves as powerful. And I think it's a really psychologically unhealthy way to grow up. You know, the Me Too movement was absolutely necessary. I'm not blaming Me Too for this. But at the same time, I think that we have created this small generation of boys that have grown up in a completely unique way, different from any other generation of boys or men before them in terms of what they're hearing. And we're seeing the effects of that now, you know, and I think the left has done a really bad job of communicating to boys and young men that they have any interest in their problems, that they care about how they feel. Again, it is this idea that Richard Reeves talks about, which is you don't have any problems, you are the problem. And I think they were pushing back on that. I think they're tired of it. I think, you know, psychologically, it's done some real damage.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are all issues that require thoughtful and nuanced discourse, which definitely cannot happen online. I'm curious, going back to you as a mom of these three wonderful young men, now that you've done this research and you've written this book, has it changed how you've parented them or how you see them?
Yeah, absolutely. In so many ways, I think it's allowed me to have way more empathy for them and for what they're going through. I think that's the starting point, you know, and to be able to advocate for them with confidence, feeling completely unconflicted now that it is not in opposition to feminism to advocate for boys and men. You know, I think I was worried about that when I first started. I was like, oh, am I going to turn into some kind of weirdo men's rights activist or something? But no, this system harms everybody, including boys. I've realized through the research that I did that boys mature slightly later than girls actually what they need is empathy and care, and for us to build the strongest relationships we can with them, you know, and to teach them these social emotional skills and to extend that kind of grace to them in the relationships we have with them. And so that's really affected my parenting, just as this baseline change in the orientation that I have towards them. You know, obviously I always knew that my role was to care for them, but I think to feel like I'm aligned with them, that their problems are all of our problems, has really helped me.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, and I encourage listeners to pick up Ruth's book. It's called Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Ruth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll delve into the impending funding shortfalls expected at our local network of community colleges. Remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. If you have any questions or comments, email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. A replay of this morning's Your Call with me is coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.